ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Josh Sternberg is our guest today. He's a journalist covering media, tech, and business. Most recently, he was the media and tech editor at Adweek. He's currently editor of The Media Nut, a newsletter for all legs of the media industry stool, brands, publishers, agencies, and ad tech. Each day, he dives into one topic, offering a mix of reporting and analysis to provide an honest look into the industry. Add it to your subscription list. It's well-written, essential reading. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
One of my favorite things about hosting a podcast is I get to reach out to people I don't know, but whose work I follow and invite them into conversation. And your newsletter is great. And each time I read it, I think that we could have an entire show talking about whatever topic it is that you're discussing. And so I'm going to have to focus in a little bit, but I'd like to start with brand studios. And you worked for two, but you still wrote that you think they're doomed to fail. And I was curious if you think it's a conception problem, an execution problem, a bit of both, or a management consultant problem.
It's all of the above.
Well, let's parse it a little bit then.
So, you know, look, for a quick little background, I was the media reporter at Digiday. And I got a phone call from the then chief revenue officer of the Washington Post saying, hey, look, you cover this nascent field of native advertising, that's what we called it back then, branded content, sponsored content, content marketing, custom publishing, whatever phrase you wanna call it. You seem to know what the landscape is all about. We had just recently been bought by the world's wealthiest man, and we need to do this. Do you want to come on board? The idea of a publisher content studio is really nothing new. Like, magazines have had custom publishing arms for decades. But what seemed really appealing at this time, this was 2014-ish, was the idea of being able to tell journalistic style stories, lowercase j journalistic style,
right,
for advertisers, understanding that we were going to use content as an advertising mechanism, which is very different than using commercials or display ads as advertising mechanisms. When you are watching a TV show and you see a commercial, you know that there's a clear delineation between that. When you're flipping through a magazine and you see a print ad, you know that there's a clear delineation between advertising and editorial. Digitally, it started to evolve where that line got blurred. And there was this promise of being able to tell readers of a particular publication that, like, look, this stuff is sponsored by a client, by an advertiser, but we are approaching it in the same way that we would approach editorial stories. They are researched, we interview people, we have an inverted lead, inverted pyramid for a story, we have an anecdotal lead, a nut graph, we talk to sources. That was the ideal. And It didn't quite pan out that way for pretty much every publisher content studio, in part because of all those things that you mentioned at the top, that these custom publishing content studios had a very tough time understanding the role of content as an advertising mechanism as opposed to an ad. And it's an important nuance, because what wound up happening is that you would see the piece that gets used the most, I mean, it did, I don't know if it still does, was the New York Times piece for Netflix for Orange is the New Black. I don't know if you remember this piece.
I don't. Describe it.
So this was a deeply reported piece about the state of women's incarceration And lots of data, lots of outside sources. It wasn't about the TV show.
Okay.
And it was billed as this is what sponsored content should be. And it is right. That is what content, sponsored content should have been. But what happened was advertisers were like, oh, well, we want to do this. And then all of a sudden, the cascade of caveats came. Well, but we also want to make sure that our brands is mentioned in the story. Oh, we want to make sure that our talking points are embedded in the story. Oh, we want to make sure that the people that are, you know, are quoted in the story are senior level executives at our company. And then pretty soon, what happened across the publishing landscape is that these pieces were less about an idea of a journalistic style piece of content that was tied to a brand attribute of what they wanted to be known for, and more about the brand or the product or service. So you would take a story that might have gone to idea as, what does the coming school year look like for XYZ type of person, and sponsored by JCPenney. And then all of a sudden became, here are five new looks that your kid can wear to school.
Right. When I had an agency, one of the things that surprised me was how a lot of companies actually don't even understand their own attributes. Mm-hmm. And so they don't even know where to start in terms of that. You have a few that are more sophisticated, let's say Nike, Netflix, where they really understand what they're about and how what they do connects to this larger idea. Yep. But the vast majority don't, and they're much more transactional. So there's that piece, but then also there's a sales, and you mentioned this in the piece that you wrote, there's a sales metrics disconnect mm-hmm. between advertising and site, like the digital publishing site metrics. And so expectations and meeting those expectations became an issue as well.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the problems. So you have a chasm between what is considered efficient for a publisher versus what is considered efficient for an advertiser. An advertiser really generally for, especially for brand awareness, you know, they don't care about publisher metrics. They're looking for their own KPIs.
Right.
And this goes back to what I was saying before about how content as an advertising mechanism, publishers and advertisers and agencies really couldn't come to an operational definition of what this meant. And that leads to a whole range of potential outcomes. Almost every single one of them ends up with the client getting mad and the publisher giving
yeah.
and the publisher giving a make good.
Right.
So you have, you know, and you couple that with the incentive of a publisher's sales team, which is misaligned with the notion of content. So if you are a sales rep and you think, all right, well, we've got this custom content play and we're going to charge $500,000 for it, you need to be able to go into an advertiser and sell that. What makes that difficult is that the sales rep will come back, you know, after talking with the agency or talking with the client and say, well, you know, they don't want to do $500,000, but you know what? They would do this package for $200,000. And the sales rep thinks, well, this is great because $200,000 is more than $0. So we're going to do that deal no matter what. And then the content studio on the back end is thinking, well, wait a minute. We built this plan for $500,000. What we're giving away now is we're not going to be able to execute on that.
So
you have the incentives are wrong, they're misaligned. And when you look at retention rates of publishers, how often does a brand re-up with a publisher for custom content? Not a lot, because of that reason,
right.
and among others. So it becomes a tangled knot of inefficiency and mediocrity by necessity.
Well, do you think it's possible for it to work in a way that is economically feasible? I mean, really, is the idea workable, or are we really dealing with a fundamental problem with digital publishing as a business model?
Yeah, I don't think it's workable as it is now.
What would it take? What would it take to make? I mean, if okay, let's say, you know, WAPO says, you know what, we want you to come back and fix our brand studio. Tell us what we need to do. What would you need to do?
I don't know, because I think that where I can see custom content really working is right now we've got about 40,000 unemployed journalists. And if you were to take these journalists, put them in a room and say, hey, look, a phone company, a smartphone company wants to do sponsored content around what we can do with 5G. And you start to tell reported stories, but instead of having it from a publisher studio, you have it from the brand directly. You hire these journalists to work for the brand and you create a studio within the brand. Now you have two things that work in your favor. You have institutional knowledge from people that work for that company, and you have reporting chops from the journalists that you brought in. The sole purpose.
But how do you place it then?
But that's where you go to your media buying firm and you say, look, we've got these assets, and you buy inventory in the same way that you buy digital display. And now all of a sudden you start changing the conversation away from let's fulfill impressions through a spreadsheet, and instead let's now create a distribution model where I can take my assets that I have, whether they are reported articles or videos, and buy inventory on publisher websites. Now, of course, this also assumes that a brand finds value in a publisher website. And I still think that's also kind of a little misguided.
Right?
We've got a 0.01% click-through rate. Display ads don't really work so well. And I find that the only studies that show how well sponsored content works come from sponsored content platforms. So
funnily enough,
I mentioned mediocrity by necessity. And I think this is a spandrel from that, is that we just do things because this is how it's been done, as opposed to actually thinking about what brings the most amount of value for all of the parties, for the brand, for the publisher, and most importantly, which everyone seems to forget about, the audience.
Right.
I would sit in meetings with marketers from brands, agency reps, and salespeople, and they would be coming up with ideas, and some of them were good and some of them were not good. And I would always ask the question, okay, now take off your industry hat. Take off your sales rep hat, take off your marketer hat. If you saw this in your feed, or if you saw this on...
Right, would you engage? Exactly. Be a person for a moment.
Exactly. How many times do you think the answer yes came up?
Well, it's it's funny because what I do when I'm wearing my other hat is consumer insights and brand strategy. And absolutely putting the consumer at the center of things is something which it is surprising how rare it is. I mean, I would say that's the big problem, let's say, with Quibi. You know, where's the consumer in that product? We got great tech. It was designed for advertisers. Where's the consumer?
Right. You came up with a solution for a problem that nobody had.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So, and I think the other piece of this that I don't know if I mentioned, but if I didn't mention, I know I've mentioned before, is that at that time in 2013, 2014, the preeminent publisher content studio arm was BuzzFeed.
Right.
And everyone was talking about that, about how good they were. And they were good in part because they kept the consumer at mind, the reader at mind, sorry.
Right.
And, you know, they would have 13 inanimate objects brought to you by Campbell's Soup. And the idea was, it was not about Campbell's Soup. It was just a fun little listicle. And that stuff worked. And other publishers were like, oh, we can do this. And they found out very quickly that they couldn't do it because the custom aspect, the quote unquote native aspect, was not built into these publishers. So if you had the New York Times or Washington Post or Wall Street Journal trying to do 13 inanimate objects brought to you by Campbell Soup, it would fail miserably because the audience is not there for that. So there's a challenge. The other aspect, and this is something that we talk about a lot, is that when publishers would sell content, they were selling not their owned and operated sites per se, they were selling their audience, no matter where that audience lived.
Yes, and not understanding that each platform has a different purpose for the audience, and so the content would be different,
And for many publishers, that audience lived in one spot. You know where that spot was?
Yes, Facebook.
Exactly. So what happens is that a publisher sells a deal, and they try, you know, they realize, well, we guaranteed a million page views or a million views on this video content, and we threw it up on our, you know, O&Os, and we got, you know, 500. So now they go to Facebook and they say, oh, Facebook, you know, let's inject some cash into some social spend and let's watch those views go up so we can fulfill those impressions or those views. And sure enough, that's what happened.
And that links really nicely to another thing I was curious about, and that's the Facebook and the Stop Hate for Profit boycott. Oh, yeah. And how that played out and what it meant really, because you have consumers not liking Facebook because it enforces tribalism. And so we're going to go after advertisers, but then how it played out. Top line for the brands participating, was it a PR move, pure and simple, do you feel?
I mean, yeah.
You can be totally, yeah, okay, end of sentence, period.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is nothing to be lost for an advertiser to use Facebook as a punching bag.
Right.
Right? It actually, now that we are 21 days into July, this will run in August, it would be foolish for a brand to not hop onto this bandwagon, right? So the idea of
Well, it doesn't hurt the brand.
No, not at all.
But it doesn't hurt Facebook either. Who does it hurt? It hurts publishers, right?
It hurts publishers from the point of view that if I am publisher A and I signed a deal with advertiser B and I need to fulfill those impressions, so I run them on Facebook, well, it puts me in a little bit of a sticky situation if I'm going to run that on Facebook because advertiser B said, well, you know, we are pulling our spend. So Pepsi said that they were pulling spend, and through Facebook ads library, I saw that some supermarket chain, I can't remember one off the top of my head, was promoting Pepsi through Facebook sponsored content. I mean, look, I feel like this was kind of a runaway train, this boycott idea. It was not the first time, it won't be the last time it happened. And it just picked up steam very quickly, in part because I think people right now are just angry. And
right.
It's, like I said before, it's easy to get mad at Facebook. So you look at companies that decide, well, you know what, we're going to draw the line in the sand and we're going to say, we're going to pull our spend from Facebook because we don't want them to make money off of their functionality of promoting hate speech. In theory, that sounds fine. So then you pull back a layer from, layer of that onion, and you find that many of these brands are spending on other websites that might not be so great.
Well, right. Or even YouTube. I mean, one of the things that I thought was interesting is, you know, they talk about the creating of extremism with Facebook, you know, that it channels extremism, and YouTube does the same thing. And then you also, there was some conflation of brand safety, that you don't want to, we want to boycott because of brand safety issues, which I didn't think was actually what the boycott was about. But YouTube has had its challenges in both brand safety and, you know, fomenting extremism, tribalism. But for whatever reason, it seemed like this particular run around the track, YouTube got a pass. Why do you think that was?
I mean, it could just be it was Facebook's turn, right? Like YouTube gets hit often, but there's something, I also think that there's a lot of animus towards Facebook.
Right.
You know, right or wrong, good or bad, there's a, for a lot of reporters and a lot of marketers, you have a direct one-to-one relationship with Facebook. With YouTube, because it's shrouded with Google, which that itself is shrouded in Alphabet, the navigating it is a little bit different. But you're right. The idea that a company says, you know, Facebook bad, but we're going to ignore all the bad stuff that happens on YouTube is disingenuous at best. And cynically at worst is, again, goes back to your question about this being a PR stunt.
Right.
I for some companies, and there are very, very, very few, actually taking a stand makes sense, right? Patagonia makes sense. They've done a lot of things to establish themselves as a careful.
Well, that's the thing is, though, isn't it earned media based on their brand attributes? I mean, going to a company that again understands their own attributes pretty well.
That's right. So a company like, I don't know, Starbucks, who says, you know, we are going to pull our ad spend on Facebook because it promotes hate, while at the same time tells its employees, look, you can't wear Black Lives Matter paraphernalia in stores.
Right. Right.
So, you know, capitalism is, you know, it's a slippery slope, right? So, you know, you can't be all good and you can't be all bad. There is that place in between. But I found this whole entire exercise just to be one just giant ball of confusion. I mean, look,
but also going to the one thing I think it, you know, sort of tying it back to the first part of our conversation, is it revealed a publisher vulnerability. And even if it was a PR stunt, right now, you know, when we're in Q3, having that happen was not good. And so if I'm a publisher and I realize this makes me pretty vulnerable, and these guys, Facebook isn't going to get hurt, but if this type of thing happens again, I'm going to get hurt. And do you think that publishers are going to start to move away, at least from the arbitrage system, what do you see happening there, if anything?
Yeah, no, publishers are both lazy and greedy. So
who isn't lazy and greedy?
Right. Yeah.
I am frustrated in my failure to achieve lazy greediness. Right.
But, you know, there's at what point do you ask yourself, you know, what phase of the fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, fool me, you know, 500 times, I don't even know what to do anymore, right? So,
right,
you know, this is not the first time that a publisher has realized that Facebook is not good for their business. But in a way, you know, Facebook is, you know, they continually dangle that carrot in front of the publisher's face. And because of the laziness, instead of thinking of something new or something interesting or something that is workable, publishers are, you know, they follow the herd. So you have a company that puts a lot of their content onto Facebook to drive traffic, and then Facebook turns the dial and that traffic dies, the publisher, instead of realizing, oh, wait a minute, maybe we need to think of other ways to drive traffic, they scramble and they say, okay, Facebook, work with us so that we can get back this traffic. And the same thing,
right.
Same thing is here now in fulfilling, you know, views on videos or impressions. You would think that after Facebook knowingly lied about video metrics, yeah, publishers would, you know, tap out. But again, they're lazy.
Yeah. When I had my agency, a lot of my clients were entertainment clients. And what happened was entertainment clients built that platform, and then the traffic was throttled by Facebook. And the reps, the Facebook reps, would tell the networks, well, now you have to start paying rent. Mm-hmm. You used to have free, and now you have to start paying rent. And it's like, well, hang on, we built your platform. But once they have the scale, they just have the scale,
right.
You know, they have the network effect and the scale, a million, you know, Cindy Lou Who's across the states, you know, and you just can't replicate that kind of audience, which is interesting. You had, I think it was yesterday or the other day, you had posted something about how you wished there was a way to access article level for local publishers. Like if I want to see one article from the Sacramento Bee, there should be some way that I can access that and they can get revenue from it, but that it doesn't break the bank. And also I don't have to log on and do a million things. Mm-hmm. And in some ways Facebook solves for that, but by doing it, it also just endangers all of those publishers.
Right. Because then those publishers are, you know, they're paying that vig to Facebook, and Facebook doesn't care about the publisher, right? Facebook cares about Facebook. It's their own business. So I think if, you know, to use the Sacramento Bee, it's like, look, I live in New Jersey, there is no reason that I'm going to pay an annual subscription for the Sacramento Bee.
Right.
But if there's a story that pops up in my newsfeed that I want to read, or something that I'm doing research on, that I find through search, it shouldn't be difficult for me to be able to pay for that article. And you know, because Facebook offers a lot of things for free, that's where people start to flock to. And you know, free, you know, nothing good comes out of free.
It certainly devalues things if things are free. One of the things I'm curious to see if it eventually happens or not is that whether blockchain can help create a system where you have micropayments, that you could have some sort of account, and this way there could be micropayments to the publishers directly, and that they could get the traffic, people could see the articles, and you know, if there was some AI built in, you could be informed, gee whiz, you know, even though you live in New Jersey, you seem to be reading the Sacramento Bee an awful lot. So maybe you want to up a subscription, you get, you know, some sort of volume discount or something. But all of this actually seems, a lot of these issues seem to really boil down to some fundamental foundational changes that are happening to media journalism because of digital. You know, you have the inability to differentiate between editorial content and news content, right? And then you have the difficulty in differentiating between crazy conspiracy theorist guy in his basement content and the New York Times, because they show up on a digital feed and they're all formatted the same. Everything is put through the same filter, and it's hard to understand the value. What are the levers that you see publishers starting to lean into? And do you think they're working?
So I'm going to dodge this question.
I know.
But here's why I'll dodge this question. Because if I knew the answer, I wouldn't be sitting here, right? If I knew the answer, I'd be so wealthy, I would have my own island. I don't know.
You could know the answer and nobody could be listening. And here I'm giving you a platform.
I would have solved the media crisis. What I kind of look at this by looking at historical models of media and how when a new medium enters, a new mass medium enters the public sphere, the previous dominant medium, the new medium takes on aspects of that. Magazines and newspapers, when digital came about, it took a lot of years for certain legacy publications to look at a website as its own thing, as opposed to taking just a PDF of their magazine and slapping it under the URL. So the way that we think about how we pull these levers in order to address these systemic challenges has to be looked at in a historical perspective of how the media has traditionally adopted new technologies. So one of the questions that I like to ask publishers is, if you were starting a media company today, what would you do? What wouldn't you do? And almost all of them say, well, I wouldn't do the biggest mistakes that we've done so far. And they start to talk in circles about the things that they are currently doing, right? So if I am looking at what can I do to create an environment that allows me as a publisher to make money, allows my journalists to create the stories that they need to create, it's hard, right? It's taking a piece of the subscription model, it's taking a piece of the advertising model, it's taking a piece of the programmatic model, and doing it in a way that I think will serve the reader. So when I go to a website and I am a subscriber, I should be, should I get ads? Since I'm already paying for that, should the backend technology know that I am a subscriber and therefore I shouldn't see ads? That could be a way to get people to subscribe. Or if I offer a monthly subscription or a micropayment option for a story, I think there are ways that we can look at this in a rational and logical way that helps readers get the information that they want to get without littering a page and slowing the page down. I mean, the amount of trackers that are on a page are a pretty good indication that publishers are not really thinking about the user experience, which then in turn means that they're not thinking about user retention or advertiser retention.
Right. Which goes back to how we were speaking earlier about really putting the consumer, that reader, front and center in every question and every strategic choice you make, you know? So we've actually run through all of our time. It went super fast. But in wrapping up, what's up next for you? What's got you particularly excited?
I don't know, man. It's hard to get excited these days.
The end of 2020.
I'm excited for a vaccine. That's really it.
Well, you have your newsletter. Are you planning on doing anything else with that? I love that newsletter, the way. And I think everybody should subscribe. It's such a thoughtful, smart, in your inbox every day. Everybody should sign up.
Thank you. The idea is, with the newsletter is that there are a lot of great media newsletters out there that give me aggregated stories or like every single media story under the sun. And I thought that there would be room for a daily media newsletter that focused on one issue. And I've got a 20-year career in various roles and aspects of the media business that I think I can lean into when talking about brands, publishers, agencies, ad tech, and analysis and theory. So I try to, it's funny. So people will sign up because they read a story about the Content Studio piece, for example. And then, they wind up unsubscribing, a week or so later because I don't go back to that topic. And I'm okay with that because for me, I want to be able to bounce around because I think having a broad understanding of the media space will allow people to change these very challenges that we have. So when I have executives at a whole slew of companies email and text me saying, hey, I read your story today and what you say makes sense here. And I'm actually talking to a buyer about this very thing today and they read your story. And now we're coming up with a better solution for our reader, which means a better solution for the advertiser and a better solution for the publisher. To me, that's I get excited about that.
That's great. Yeah. Well, I think it's such a good resource. I think anybody working in the business, especially digital publishing, because it touches on so many aspects of it, I think it's a great education, really. And it can inform what people are doing and make them better at their jobs. And it's just, you know, everybody should be curious and it fulfills that curiosity itch so that we can scratch or scratch. I don't know, the metaphor is messed up there. But anyway, thank you so much. No, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.